So in the coming three lectures, this is a bit of autobiography, if you like. I was originally trained as a historian. Very interested in ideas about what is history and how you write it. And this gave me the opportunity to return to some of that stuff. Now, in the last lecture, I mentioned how Samuel Bierskow compares ancient historiography with modern oral history. Comparisons of that kind, of course, run the risk of anachronism. If we simply project onto ancient historians aspects of modern historical approaches of which they were innocent. But comparisons of that kind can also, if we use them carefully, be heuristically very helpful. The heuristic approach is to allow a modern phenomenon, in this case a historiographical method or approach, to highlight features of the ancient material that we might not otherwise have noticed. History is not just a matter of reading texts and evidence carefully, it's also a matter of what one looks for and notices in the evidence. Study of the history of historiography quickly shows how regularly historians just do not see things that, once we have seen them, would seem to be staring them in the face. That's true of major elements in history, also of more subtle matters. And often it's something from the historian's present context or concerns that opens their eyes to something in the past that other historians had not seen. So while anachronism is a peril to look out for, the danger, I think, should not deter us from seeking the potential rewards of heuristic comparison of this kind. Now, in the last half century or so, the nature and practice of historiography have been in constant crisis, debate, experimentation, and reformulation. And in the last lecture of the series, I shall try to sketch that debate as a whole and look at the new directions that have emerged from it fairly recently. But for the time being, because I want to exploit particularly one of these new approaches, so-called history from below, for its potential to illuminate the Gospels, I'm going to confine myself now to explaining just this one modern approach to history, which dates from the 1960s. And re-envisaging the Gospels as, in some sense, history from below will occupy two lectures, this one and the first one tomorrow. So, what is history from below? The term was used by a group of British historians, most notably E.P. Thompson and George Rudet, who pioneered this approach in the 1960s. Early classics of this sort of history were Thompson's The Making of the English Working Class, published in 1963, and Rudet's The Crowd in the French Revolution, published in 1959. The term became widely current, though an alternative term, people's history, has become perhaps more popular recently. History from below began in conscious opposition to traditional history, understood as history from above, that is, history from the perspective of the ruling elites. From antiquity onwards, we'll see more of this tomorrow about ancient history, from antiquity onwards, history proper was political and military history, recounted as the doings of the ruling class, and from their perspective. In such history, the common people usually appear only as an anonymous mass. History from below attempts not only a social history of ordinary life, but to view history from the perspective of the common people. It supposes that history or society looks different from the perspectives of different classes or groups within it. Working class history, observes Neil Asherson, is not just the history of the working class, but history as perceived by the working class, a very much more ambitious undertaking. From such a perspective, the common people are not just objects of the deeds and policies of the great, but subjects of their own history. History from Below reveals, in E.P. Thompson's words, the agency of working people, the degree to which they contributed by conscious efforts to the making of history. His classic book has been described as a panoramic account of the self-making of the working class in Britain, conceived as a counter-narrative to the prevalent accounts of British political history, which see it as a kind of gradual development of democracy by Parliament, and therefore something that just happens to the common people rather than something they participated significantly in. And George Roudet's work has been praised for putting faces on the crowd. In his The Crowd in the French Revolution, he sought to understand from within the crowd, as it were, how it behaved, how it was composed, what it set out to achieve, and how far its aims were realised, unquote. An important element in History from Below is the attempt to recover the ideology of the common people, especially the ideology that informed movements of protest or resistance and rebellion. And Thompson, again, was pioneering in taking seriously the popular traditions and culture that informed the movements of protest and change through which ordinary people made a difference. The work of such historians focused on modern periods in which working people collectively took a decisive role in the course of events and for which, moreover, there is abundant evidence. You might think about how one would write a history of recent events in Egypt, and you might conclude that there's lots of evidence for how the people in Tahrir Square were thinking and so forth. You could reconstruct it from the perspective of the ordinary people because loads of evidence is currently available for that. But the further back the historian goes, of course, generally speaking, the more meagre the evidence for use in History from Below. Michael Parenti has attempted a people's history of the Roman Republic. And he points out how virtually all our sources were written by those he calls gentlemen scholars, who wrote from the perspective of Roman aristocrats concerned to protect their privilege, and really had nothing but contempt for the ordinary people of the city of Rome. He also alleges that this patrician perspective has carried over into the work of most modern historians of Rome. His own revisionist story depends on reading the same evidence against the grain, as it were, as a story of popular protest and resistance against oppression and in favour of more equitable and democratic policies. The result, however, is that actually Parenti's narrative turns out to be largely the story of those members of the Roman elite who adopted the cause of the common people and were regarded by the rest of their class as dangerous and seditious demagogues. So we hear about the Gracchi, Clodius, Catiline, Julius Caesar, but the people themselves still remain the anonymous mob who supported them. In line with the aims of History from Below, Parenti claims for them the role of agents in their own history. He says, in all the proletariat played a crucial but much ignored role in the struggle for democratic policies in ancient Rome. They showed themselves to be neither a mindless nor a shiftless rabble, but a politically aware force capable of registering preferences in accordance with their needs and able to distinguish friend from foe. Now, this may well be right, but the extent to which we can see it from their perspective is actually extremely limited by the nature of the evidence. This case is somewhat parallel to one with which New Testament scholars will be more familiar, which is the use of the Jewish historian Josephus to reconstruct the popular movements of resistance and revolution in first century Jewish Palestine, leading up to the Great Revolt of 66 to 70. Movements which Josephus, aristocratic and pro-Roman, as he was when he was writing it, historian, profoundly despised. Richard Hawes's work in particular has attempted a reconstruction of these popular movements through reimagining, with the help of other sources, the religio-political ideas that inspired the political leaders and their followers. Indeed, Horsley's broad programme of research pursued as in a whole series of volumes is really very much like a history of Christian origins from below in the manner of E.P. Thompson. Horsley offers a more extensive reconstruction of the mental world of the common people of Jewish Palestine than Parenti attempts or was able to do for the Roman plebs. In doing so, Horsley offers more hostages to criticism, of course, both in his interpretation of the evidence and of his use of social scientific models, which become very important in his work. And I would make a number of quite serious criticisms of his work myself, but the work does also encourage me to think that reconstruction of this kind is something historians can feasibly attempt. And if we get it wrong and have to criticise each other, that's the ordinary practice of history. But Horsley, I think, shows that it's perhaps worth seriously attempting. This kind of rewriting of a narrative from the perspective of below, which in our available literature is recounted from above, can, of course, be much assisted by the considerable means for reconstructing the way of life of common people that archaeology now affords, along with the critical assembling of the scattered information about this life of ordinary people that we can gain from the literature. In Horsley's case, his books on Galilee supply this kind of social historical depth of context for the stories of popular movements, including that of Jesus. The prospects for writing ancient history from below, therefore, are not negligible, restricted though they must be, must seem by comparison with later periods, and especially in view of the nature of the primary literature. However, my primary purpose now is not primarily to discuss the writing of ancient history from below by historians today, but rather to use this notion to illuminate the Gospels in the context of ancient historiography. Can the Gospels themselves be classified as history from below? And if so, does this distinguish them from the historiography and biography of the ancient world with which we have compared them in my last lecture? So let's turn to the social world of the Gospels, and the rest of this lecture will be devoted to reconstructing the social world of the Gospels. In the first lecture tomorrow, we'll look at the implications of this, draw out the implications for the sort of history the Gospels are. But to determine, as it were, the social level of people in the Gospels, we do need some kind of a model. I'm jumping ahead of myself there. I think, first of all, I think it's actually a weakness. Richard Burridge does so much in his book that I'm not really criticising him. But he doesn't discuss at all the social setting of the narrative of the Gospels. And I don't mean the social setting in which the Gospels were written or which they addressed, the social setting of the narrative within the Gospel stories. But this surely does have some relevance to the sort of literature the Gospels are. And furthermore, as we shall see, the social perspective of the Gospel narratives is what marks them out most strikingly from the whole corpus of ancient historiography and biography. Now, you have on the handouts charts that I prepared showing the place of individuals mentioned in each of the Gospels within a sort of social stratification of society, the kind of society in which they lived. They're major characters, minor characters. You've got the figures at the top of each sheet. I can't put every character in the Gospels into this scheme because sometimes there's just not the information to do so. But quite a large percentage of the characters I've tried to fit in. Now, to do something like this, we do need some sort of model of the kind of society in question. And I've worked from a basic model of a so-called advanced agrarian society, which has been widely used by ancient historians and New Testament scholars. Now, it's a very generalizing one. It's supposed to apply to all kinds of agrarian society in different periods and places of history. It doesn't in itself take account of the specifics of any particular historical society. And so, as with all social scientific models, I think, it's only useful if one's prepared to test it against the actual evidence for the society in question, and to modify it accordingly. Now, in the course of working with this model, I've come to think it requires rather more modification than I first thought, and it's quite possible it will need further modification still, perhaps particularly in view of the increasing archaeological evidence. It's new stuff coming to light all the time that's relevant to this kind of issue of social structure and status. But one has to start somewhere, and I think the broad picture that comes through in these charts, even if I've got some details wrong, is likely to be reliable for the purposes I want to put it to. Now, in a society like this, a large majority of the population, typically 70 to 80%, they say, comprises what I've called the common people. The term peasants has been widely used for most of these people, and if we take it in its broadest, simplest sense, referring to people who work the land and live directly from the land, then it's appropriate, I think. These people I call the common people would mostly be farming families who work their own small holdings, tenant farmers who rent their farms from large landowners, and agricultural workers employed on farms, either as slaves or as hired labourers. But unfortunately, the term peasant now comes to us rather freighted with additional and more dubious assumptions that come from theoretical generalising about the nature of pre-modern agrarian societies. And this kind of theorising has recently come in for some quite trenchant criticism. So I do think we need to be a bit careful about if we use the word peasant, what we're sort of carrying over along with that word into our thinking. We cannot assume, for example, that there was no significant economic disparity among such farming people, and we cannot assume that none of them made sufficient surplus to engage in trade, for example. Nor can we assume, and this is probably most significant for us, we can't assume much about the attitudes and ideas of these people just from the fact that they were, in a broad sense, peasants. However, it is certainly the case that most of the common people supported themselves to a large extent either from the produce of their own farms or from what they received by working other people's land. It's also the case that other categories of ordinary people, such as artisans, fishers, and small traders, should be considered alongside farmers as far as their economic and social level goes. We do have to avoid the most common mistake. We do have to avoid the anachronistic idea of a middle class in ancient society. Not because some of the common people were not a good deal more prosperous than others, it's probably true, but rather because there wasn't a class of people defined by their occupations that put them in a sort of middle position between the elite and the common people. That's what the middle class has come to mean in modern societies and in histories of modern societies. At most, there were some rich merchants, like the one in Jesus' parable, who would probably aspire to buy land and to join the elite. So there isn't any kind of stable middle group there between the elite and the common people, with the exception of the retainers, who are rather different. I'll come to them in a moment. Now, the common people would not have considered themselves either rich or poor. The rich were the elite, and their wealth far exceeded even the most prosperous of the common people. We might consider many of the common people poor, for they lived fairly close to subsistent level. But they would have considered themselves the social norm. The poor were the destitute, people who lived pretty much hand to mouth with no security of income. And we'll turn to them in a moment. Now, among those that I've called the common people, there was doubtless a range of relative prosperity. It's not easy to estimate proportions, but an aerial survey of Galilee showed the majority of farm plots were about 4 acres, a size that would support a family of 6 to 9 members. That's about the size of Jesus' family, of course, probably quite typical. It would support a family of 6 to 9 members only at subsistence level. On the other hand, it was quite possible for those with an inadequate amount of land to supplement their income from other activities, such as producing pottery or textiles, or smoking and pickling fish for export. Some Galilean villages maintained small industries. Most notably well known to archaeologists now, Kfar Hananiya in Upper Galilee produced pottery, household vessels, that are found all over Galilee by the archaeologists, and especially in the city of Sepphoris. Now, some indication of the social stratification that might exist within a Galilean village comes from the excavations of 3 particular places in Galilee. Kirbat Kana, which is probably, it's the most likely site of the Cana that's mentioned in John's Gospel, and the other two are not mentioned in the Gospels. They're mentioned by Josephus, Jotapata, and Gamala. Now, in these 3 places, some very high-quality housing has been found, along with many simpler houses. And Peter Richardson says that the archaeologists are developing a 3-item typology of differentiated neighbourhoods within such villages, the three types of house being houses with central courtyards, which would have belonged to the most prosperous people in the village, houses with side courtyards, and terrace housing without courtyards at all. But archaeological findings like that always require interpretation. The most obvious question is who lived in the most opulent of these homes. Possibly some particularly prosperous small farmers or artisans, but maybe not members of the common people at all. They might be tax collectors or estate overseers employed by the aristocratic owners of large estates. Both of those come in the category I'm calling retainers, and we still have to consider who they were in a moment. Or they might consist of local gentry with quite large estates, people I'm categorising as local elite. So there is a question, really. We know there's this economic disparity, but quite what sort of people are the best off in these villages is not entirely clear. We have to guess for the time being. Now, by no means all villages were as prosperous as Cana, Gamala, and Jotapata. In Nazareth, a very small village, and Capernaum and Bethsaida, both fishing villages, only quite simple homes have been found, so far at least. Incidentally, if Cana was a prosperous, and Nazareth, a neighbouring but much less prosperous village, then what Nathanael, who came from Cana, what Nathanael says, you remember, in the first chapter of John, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" gains extra force It's the contempt of the prospering village for the one just down the road that's very far from prospering. Quite often, also, the claim has been made that at the wedding of Cana that Jesus attended with his mother in John's Gospel, the family that's holding the wedding seems to have been quite well-to-do. And that does fit nicely with what we now know about the inhabitants of Cana from their houses. Still sticking with the common people for a while, we should note that evidently many quite ordinary people owned slaves or employed hired labour. So Jesus, according to Luke 17:7, can say to his disciples, "Who among you would say to your slave who has just come from ploughing or tending sheep?" And so on. Even a quite small farmer might need to take on extra workers during harvest. The fact that Zebedee and his sons employed some hired labourers in their fishing business does not necessarily make them particularly prosperous. Hired labour was probably pretty cheap because there was likely to have been a surplus of it. The common people were not the poor, but many of them probably lived in serious danger of becoming poor. Even the owner of a relatively large smallholding might be forced by a few bad harvests to get into debt to the elite or their retainers, and then be deprived of his land, often through dubious legal means. Tenant farmers were even more vulnerable to losing their land, but smallholders and tenants had relative security of living compared with the acute insecurity of those who neither owned nor rented land. This lack of security, living on the edge of total destitution and starvation, defines the poor. Seasonal workers, but especially casual workers, the so-called day labourers, are typical. Day labourers are employed no more than a day at a time. They really do live from hand to mouth, never earning enough to save anything, living with the ever-present prospect of unemployment. And these are the people for whom it made only too obvious sense to pray for their bread daily, as Jesus taught. It might actually be better to sell oneself into slavery, for a slave had at least some security, and it was in the master's interest to provide for his slaves sufficiently for them to remain useful labour. Whereas the employer had no interest particularly in paying casual workers very much, because there were always more of them available. For people who found themselves destitute, selling themselves as slaves was one option. Others were to beg, or to take to the hills and join the many gangs of bandits. Gangs of bandits probably also included people like deserting soldiers and runaway slaves. Some people had no choice but to beg. Only a wealthy family could support seriously disabled or chronically ill people who could not work. Most such people must have become beggars. At least in Jewish Palestine, charitable giving to the poor was a well-recognized duty, and rights such as gleaning were enshrined in law. Jewish society was a good deal kinder in general to the destitute than was the rule in the Roman Empire. But serious destitution there undoubtedly was, as the Gospels themselves confirm. It's debated whether poverty was actually increasing in this period, but that doesn't matter particularly for our present purposes. In any case, there were a good many destitute people around. Now, unlike some scholars who take their models from social anthropology, I doubt that the Jewish purity rules were a major factor in social discrimination, except, of course, in the case of lepers, who I think is a special case. It's not true that the common people didn't concern themselves with ritual purity. Plenty of archaeological evidence that they did. Probably they didn't mostly follow the precise, scrupulous practice of the Pharisees, but they did practice ritual purity, bathing and so forth. Nor did simply being impure, ritually impure, make one an outcast. Certain conditions, particularly the contagious skin disease, English Bibles usually call leprosy, did isolate people from society. But it doesn't seem that, for example, demon-possessed people, another category of people we meet quite a lot in the Gospels, it doesn't seem that demon possession necessarily banished people from family or society, though extreme cases might do so, like the man Jesus encountered at Gerasa, who calls himself Legion. So my charts distinguish between the poor, which includes beggars, and a category of outcasts. And they include, for example, publicly notorious sinners, people like prostitutes, gamblers, usurers, who were thoroughly disapproved by society at large, but not necessarily poor. The matter of where to put people, I mean, there are some real issues when you try to decide how to categorize people, and particularly the sort of social status and economic status are not necessarily congruent. So the toll collectors, the tax collectors, are a bit of a problem because they were outcasts in the sense of how they were regarded, but they might often be quite wealthy. I've put them in the category of retainers, but you could put them in the category of outcasts. Well, moving up the scale now from the common people to the retainers, this term is used for a small part of the population, the people who made their living by serving the wealthy elite. And they may, again, the economics range here may be quite large. People who made a really good living, people who made just a simple living from serving the elite. Now, I've not included here all those that one could put this into category. Particularly, you'll see I've put all slaves together. But slaves of the high priest, you might well regard those as retainers. So there's some issues here as to quite how one categorizes this. A lot of scholars put Pharisees in this category of retainers, but I don't think they belong there. And nor do I think the ordinary priests, the priests who lived in the villages and were only in the Jerusalem temple a couple of weeks in the year, I don't think those are really retainers either. I categorize them with the common people. So finally, among these various classes, the elite, people at the top of the diagrams. Here I've included both rulers and aristocracy because it's not easy to make a distinction between those. Rulers and aristocracy. And I've also included the urban elite, people who lived, very wealthy people who lived in places like Tiberias and Jerusalem and Jericho. These are wealthy people who usually owned big estates in the country but lived most of the time in the towns. Those are the urban elite. I've also included the rural elite, who are the leading people in villages. They're a bit problematic. It's quite hard to tell the sort of wealth or status of these local elite. And very interesting result from archaeology is that in Galilee, most of our gospel evidence, of course, relates to Galilee, the elite were less culturally distinguished from the common people than the Jerusalem elite were. But between the Jerusalem elite and most Jews, there was a great gulf fixed, not only by wealth, but also by cultural ethos. The elite displayed their superior status in the adoption of Greek and Roman customs and possessions into their daily life. So you'd have far more borrowing from Greek and Roman culture among the wealthy elite in Jerusalem than you would have among the common people. And this is not just a matter of expense. The common people seem to have adopted a rather plain style of living in terms of household utensils and all sorts of things like that, not just for economic reasons, but also to indicate their Jewish identity and solidarity. It does look as though people in general wanted to distinguish themselves, wanted in some sense culturally to resist the influence of pagan culture, whereas the wealthy elite were much happier with it. Typically in advanced agrarian societies, the elite comprise only 2% of the population and control more than half the wealth of the society. Again, this is a very general point. We shouldn't apply it mechanically to first century Palestine, but it may be a rough guide to the proportions of these different levels of society. Now, from now on, I want to concentrate on Marx as sort of as an example. I'll take you through some features of Marx's diagram, and I'll say a little bit later about the sort of differences among the other Gospels. And first of all, I'll just go through and explain to you why I've located some of the characters in the categories I have. And, you know, in some cases we can be rather more certain about where they belong in the social scale than in others, and in some cases you may not see why I've put them somewhere unless I explain it. So there's a little bit about that. Let's begin with the Jerusalem elite. Joseph of Arimathea very clearly belongs to the Jerusalem elite because he's on the high priest's council, and therefore he must be the head of one of the great aristocratic families of Jerusalem. He's Joseph of Arimathea because he doubtless owns a large estate somewhere. The location of Arimathea is not entirely clear, but somewhere in the country he owns a large estate which gives him his wealth, but he resides mostly in the city, like most other aristocratic landowners. Simon the leper, so-called, who had a house in Bethany, large enough to accommodate a sizable dinner party, according to Mark, may well have been wealthy. It's hard to be as sure about that as one may be about Joseph, for example. Simon was the commonest of all Jewish male names. Very, very common. You just think about or look up how many Simons, how many different Simons there are in the New Testament, you can see this. And if you were called Simon, you needed something else to distinguish you from other Simons. So this Simon has a nickname, the leper. He couldn't have been actually suffering from unclean skin disease at the time of the incident because he would have to be quarantined. You know, he couldn't be mixing with people if he had been a leper. He might have been a leper in the past, maybe healed by Jesus, or possibly there was something about him that people gave him the nickname of leper. He wasn't actually a leper, but for some reason they might have called him that. So we don't really know, but he couldn't have been a leper at the time. So he doesn't fit into the outcast category. The woman who anointed Jesus on this occasion has that hugely expensive ointment. If that's her own ointment, she must have belonged to a wealthy family. And that inclines me to think Simon, who's her host on this occasion, was also probably wealthy. Now, the next one illustrates how difficult these things can be. I used to be pretty clear that the owner of the house where Jesus and the disciples celebrate the Passover must be wealthy, since he has a large upper room available for the purpose. but I'm now better informed. An upper room was a standard part of an ordinary house, which would have a ground floor used for storage and everyday business, and the living quarters of the family upstairs. Now, at Passover time, a family might well vacate their usual living quarters and let it out to pilgrims. So the fact this the further fact, again, inclines one perhaps to think of a relatively wealthy family, but the fact that they have a domestic slave, the man who carries the water jar, you remember when the disciples locate the place Jesus has arranged, they know it because of the man, almost certainly a slave. Women carried water jars, men didn't unless they were slaves. So the family got a slave, but again, as I've said before, it doesn't necessarily indicate particularly high social status. So one can't be sure about this. I'm still inclined to guess that this is a quite wealthy residence, but there are things to be said on both sides there. If we turn to the local elite, we've got Jairus and his family. It's pretty clear, I think, that they do belong to the local elite. He's a ruler of the synagogue, and that means not the building in this case, but the assembly, the village assembly, which had presumably had several rulers of the synagogue. But he must be someone, therefore, of high standing in the village. And his house apparently has more than one room, another minor indication. So he must have been among the most prosperous people in the village. Probably that's as much as we can say. Now let's come to artisans, which has a special interest, of course, because Jesus is an artisan, according to Mark. Mark calls Jesus a tecton, which is a fairly general word that could include working in stone as well as wood. Nazareth may have had no more than about 400, 500 inhabitants. And so it's possible that Jesus' business served several villages, or that he was an itinerant worker, or even that he was employed on large building projects in the nearby city of Sepphoris, established during that period, as some scholars have guessed. However, there's a bit of evidence about Jesus' family, their economic standing, which has rarely been taken into account. And I think it's very interesting. There's a report from a writer called Hegesippus, who in the late 2nd century recorded some traditions from Palestinian Jewish Christians who had preserved especially traditions about the family of Jesus and their descendants. And he tells us about two grandsons of Jesus' brother Judas, Jude. These are therefore great nephews of Jesus. They must have been living around the end of the first century. They were called James and Zochar. But the key thing is they're farmers. And the tradition reports the exact size of the farm, which was 39 plethora, which suggests the farm was well known. It's not likely to have that sort of very exact, it's not a round number, it's an exact figure. It seems to me likely to be not just legend, but an actual memory of the size of the ancestral farm of Jesus' family that would have been passed down in the family. So it may be that carpentry was not the main occupation of the family, but the one that Jesus practiced in order to supplement the family's income from the land, which was a common practice. And of course, you see, most people in Nazareth would be farmers, so to distinguish Jesus, you'd call him the carpenter. Because that's the thing that distinguishes himself from everyone else. But it doesn't mean that he may not have farmed, or that his family may not have farmed the family farm, as well as Jesus practicing carpentry. So I think that opens up some wider possibilities than we necessarily think of in relation to Jesus' occupation before he began his ministry. Let's have a look at fishermen, who are important because at least four of Jesus' small group of disciples were fishers, and they include, those four include the three who were a sort of inner circle of the 12, Peter, James, and John. And when we notice also how often Mark's Jesus is found in their boats and crossing the lake from one side to another, from one of the harbours around the Sea of Galilee to another, it's clear that the Galilean fishing industry was a major social context of Jesus' ministry. Zebedee and his two sons, along with Peter and Andrew, formed a cooperative of two fishing families who also hired some labourers, mentioned in Mark 1:20. But the image of this as a prosperous, free enterprise business that locates the fishermen in a middle class with a social status above average is anachronistic. Probably they leased the fishing rights from a toll collector, maybe Mark's Levi, who worked on behalf of Herod Antipas. The contract would give the toll collector the right to a sizable percentage of all catches. According to John's Gospel, Peter and Andrew came from Bethsaida, where excavated houses of fishing people. And we know that because there are fishing hooks and all kinds of things in the houses. But they're very simple houses fishing people had in Bethsaida. And John Chrysostom, the later church father, but he knew the social world of his time, Chrysostom certainly thought that a fisherman on the Lake of Galilee would have been very low on the social and economic scale. Now let me quickly say something about, if we move now down to farmers and farm workers, there is a very strange aspect of the charts, all four of them, at first sight, because the vast majority of Palestinian Jews farmed the land. There's no doubt about that. They owned their own small holdings or tenant farmers or agricultural workers. But only one such person appears explicitly among the individuals in Mark's Gospel, Simon of Cyrene. Because when Simon appears in Mark's story, 15:21, he's returning to Jerusalem from working in the fields. Since Simon was an immigrant from the Jewish diaspora, most likely he doesn't own or rent a farm but has been working someone else's land. But why are there no other farmers or agricultural workers among the characters of the Gospels, of the Gospel? I think the answer must be that just because such people were the vast majority of all the people, it isn't necessary to label people as such. Most people who are not attributed to some other occupation or social status by Mark can be assumed to be farmers or agricultural workers. So probably most members of the 12, other than the four fishermen from Matthew's Gospel, we know Matthew was a tax collector, but probably most other members of the 12 were farmers or agricultural workers. And of course the crowds that throng most of Mark's narrative, who are not on the charts because I've only included individuals in the charts, but the general crowds would have been overwhelmingly farmers or agricultural workers. Let me move, I'm running out of time a bit. Let me just mention, you've got the poor there, the genuinely poor. You've got the disabled beggars, and there are five of the five disabled people in Mark, Bartimaeus and others. Bartimaeus is certainly a beggar. It's very likely the others were also beggars. And then the category of outcasts, and I just want to mention the Syrophoenician woman and her daughter. I've classified them as outcasts actually simply because they were Gentiles. In their own society, they wouldn't be outcasts, but from the Jewish perspective, they were outcasts. So I think that's where they have to belong in a chart of Jewish society. So those are some comments on the details of the chart. Let me now finally make a couple of general comments on the chart. First, Mark's chart, and then a word about the other Gospels. The fact that Mark, like the others, has such a large number of individual characters in his Gospel is what makes it possible for these characters to portray in some detail the social stratification of the narrative world of Mark's Gospel. Of course, it is Mark's narrative world. It's the narrative world he's constructed by telling these stories, putting them together as his Gospel. And, of course, Mark hasn't been trying to produce a kind of representative sample of the social mix of first century Palestine. The people appear because they play some part in the stories he's telling. But that, in a sense, I think, makes it even more striking that the result is a world that corresponds accurately to what we otherwise know of the social particularities of first century Jewish Palestine. The only other scholar, to my knowledge, who's really done anything like this kind of attempt to classify Mark's characters socially, or indeed the other Gospels, the only one who's done anything like this is Richard Rohrbach, and he concludes that Mark's narrative world, quote, accurately recreates the sharply stratified peasant society, he goes on to claim that while at some points it corresponds with the real world of Jesus, at others it certainly does not. Now, I'm quite at a loss to understand that second comment. What are the points at which Mark's narrative world doesn't correspond to the real social world as we know about it? Rohrbach doesn't tell us, and I really don't understand what he's thinking of there. Seems to me there's no good reason to doubt that this is a very accurate portrayal of the kind of world in which Jesus and his disciples actually lived. It is predominantly the world of the common people. But it's also the case that both the highest category, the elite, and the lowest categories, the poor and outcasts, are very well represented, actually overrepresented statistically, if you like, in Mark's characters. As I said, the characters figure in the story because of their roles within the stories about Jesus. But it is notable, I think, unlike almost all narrative literature from the ancient world, and I'll say more about that in the next lecture, unlike most narrative literature, almost all narrative literature from the ancient world, the whole range of social categories, from the ruling elite to the outcasts, is well represented in Mark's Gospel. One point I haven't yet explained about the charts is that I've put in bold print the characters who are friends or followers of Jesus, and also the people he healed. And that enables us to see that the people who are related in some way to Jesus' own movement, if you like, span the whole social range, with supporters, beneficiaries, right down from Joseph of Arimathea to a leper and even Gentiles. And note also that women are included right across the spectrum. This said, the concentration of beneficiaries of Jesus in the lowest strata is contextually a very remarkable feature. Equally remarkable, perhaps, is the fact that with a few exceptions, such as Jairus, the elite appear in the story not for their own sake so much as because of the way they impinge on the world of the common people. And this is the reverse of virtually all other ancient historiography, in which the common people appear only when and because they impinge on the world of the elite. Mark's Gospel turns history upside down. It's history from below, in stark contrast to the history from above that was generally considered real history in the ancient world. Now, finally, the last comment, I'll just say something about the charts for the other three Gospels. You can look through these at your leisure. You may find interesting things within them in detail. But briefly, I'll just say this. Matthew, who has only a few more characters than Mark, presents roughly the same picture as Mark. There is a slightly larger proportion of elite persons in Matthew, mainly because of his birth and infancy narrative, which includes people like Herod and Herod's sons and so forth. But apart from those sort of extra elite who are there for that particular reason, it's very much like Mark. Now, Luke has many more characters than any of the other Gospels, interesting feature of Luke. And so Luke provides the richest data for analysis. And broadly, the pattern is the same, with more characters in each of the categories. Luke's attempt in chapters 2 and 3 of his Gospel to place his narrative chronologically by reference to world history accounts for a large number of ruling elite figures, even including two Roman emperors. But they're there just to provide you with dates, really, in many cases. The observation that most of the elite appear because of the way they impinge on the world of the ordinary people, rather than the reverse, holds largely true for Luke as for the other synoptics. Finally, John's Gospel, despite its length, has considerably fewer characters than even Mark. It's a notable feature of John's Gospel that he has a quite different literary approach, procedure. John typically tells individual stories at much greater length than the other evangelists do, with the result that he has far fewer characters, because he has far fewer actual different events. Given that, the spread remains similar, but with one notable difference. I think the proportionately large number of elite persons who are in the category of friends, followers, and beneficiaries of Jesus is rather striking, and particularly the number of Jerusalem elite people who are associated with Jesus' movement in some way. I think that's a bit special to John's Gospel, and it may be indicative of the particular circle of disciples from which the special traditions that we have in John mainly derive. They do shift the predominant perspective of this Gospel compared with the others. In this Gospel, perhaps, we see Jesus and his world more from an elite perspective. Though we shouldn't exaggerate this, remember that John's rather few miracle stories do include two disabled beggars. So he's got the people right at the bottom of the scale, but there's a bit more of an elite perspective on Jesus in this Gospel, distinguished from the others. So that concludes the sort of analysis of the social world of the Gospels that I want to make, and tomorrow morning we'll see the significance, really, of that in terms of comparing with other ancient history and what it reveals about the sort of history the Gospels are.
Okay, lots of good information there, and my question was going to be, what are some of the implications? But I guess that's the cliffhanger.
Yeah,
is that right? Yes. Okay. So we do have about 10 minutes, and if you want to ask any clarifying questions or details on this, and then we'll take a little break, and then there'll be the book signing outside. So again, just come to the mics as you desire.
I know there's been a lot of archaeological discoveries in the last 20 years since Robinson wrote his book, The Priority of John, but he did argue, based on some evidence, that some families both ran a fishing trade in Galilee and put it down to Jerusalem on caravans to sell the salted fish there, and that it was a lucrative trade. Could you comment on whether you disagree with that?
does he actually offer any evidence of that? As opposed, for example, for the model whereby the fisherman caught the fish and passed them on to other people who did the smoking and salting, and to other people who travelled around selling them in Jerusalem and other places. That seems to me much more likely than the same people doing all of it. And as far as I can, I may be wrong, but as far as I can remember, he just sort of postulates that rather than actually producing any evidence for that. I'll check sometime and see whether that's right, but I think that's right.
Go along with what you said about Mark's gospel representing both elite and poor comparative to other ancient sources. Could it be, but maybe not the primary reason that he does that, is because it's indicative of the class in which Jesus came from? Is that right, or mm-hmm. would you oppose that in some reasons?
I'll say a bit more about that tomorrow, but yes, I think it does reflect that Jesus himself was a man of the ordinary people. But I think it also reflects Jesus' deliberate choice of the people he went out of his way to meet and help. You know, I don't think that Jesus limited his ministry in any way. We find him with elite people. But he does seem to have, you know, given special attention to people like the lepers and the outcasts of various kinds. So I think there's something to do with how Jesus understood and pursued his ministry there, as well as, you know, where he comes from himself. But I will say a bit more tomorrow.
Just wondering if you could comment on rates of literacy and religious education, especially in Galilee.
It's a very interesting question. And everybody now, most people, say the Roman Empire, 10% of people were literate, which is based on a book by a man called Harris, which everybody follows as authoritative. It's a very good book. But I see, and so far I've only read a brief review of it, a new book, which actually argues for a much wider evidence of literacy among people, at least in the eastern part of the empire, where I think the evidence comes from. And the argument, I gather, is that you know, most of what's survived has been literature written by the elite, and of course only the elite wrote literature, probably. But if one thinks about the way that writing may have been used by ordinary people, for example, in their business affairs, running the farm, or things of that sort, then it appears there's evidence that people haven't given much attention to, which suggests that that level of literacy, which would not be a kind of very literary level, but sort of very ordinary use of writing in daily life, may be more widespread than we have tended to think. Literacy, of course, is not the same thing as education. Actually, for example, the aristocracy would often be quite highly educated, but they'd give the writing to their scribes to do, their slaves who are better at, they've been trained to write well, and very often they would read books by having a slave read it to them. So you could be very knowledgeable, but not actually practice literacy very much. And you could apply that to the more ordinary people, say in Galilee, if they're attending Sabbath every Saturday, you know, they're hearing the scriptures read. They may well hear, they almost certainly did hear, preaching based on the scriptures and so forth. So they could actually be quite well educated in their religion, in the history of their people, in an oral culture based on text. And that's I think, the sort of oral culture we need to think of, an oral culture that has important texts within it. And people don't necessarily read them physically themselves. It's the same with the reception of the Gospels, you know, that they would almost certainly have been read in community rather than sort of the way we read them, perhaps, not always, of course, but sometimes we read them individually in our own rooms or whatever. Mostly, the Gospels would have been read communally and therefore heard. The other thing that people do say about synagogues in Galilee is that, and I'm not too sure that there's any terribly good evidence for this at such a date, really, but people sometimes say, you know, people would be trained to read the scriptures aloud, you know. And it may be that people like Jairus, the rulers of the synagogue, may well have taken that sort of role, somebody did, that sort of role in synagogue worship, reading the scriptures and leading in prayer. And of course that meant learning how to read Hebrew, which was not the ordinary speech of daily life. Probably, that's another interesting issue, is language competence. And it does look as though most people's sort of basic language, their native language, Aramaic. But Hebrew, of course, which in many ways resembles Aramaic. So if you spoke Aramaic, it would be much easier to learn some Hebrew. You know, people would have some Hebrew, probably, at least from listening to scripture, although, you know, you'd listen to scripture, you'd have an Aramaic interpretation of it, but you would listen to the scripture. So sort of gradually you would presumably pick up some knowledge of Hebrew. And Greek, I often think that Greek was perhaps rather like English is in the Middle East today. You know, you can go to a Middle Eastern village and the little boys can come up to you wanting to use their sort of 10 words of English. In other words, a little bit of Greek would have been quite widely spread, and some people would have a good deal more than others. And remember that both Greek and Aramaic were the international languages, and Palestine was positioned, as it were, especially Jewish Palestine, positioned between the eastern world of Babylon, and where there were loads of Jews and, you know, lots of communication eastwards from Jerusalem. And that's an Aramaic-speaking world, primarily. And then the sort of western facing world, where Greek was the international language, and the two overlapped. So it was, you know, the Americans and the British are very bad at languages, but a lot of peoples in the world, you know, live in overlaps of languages or societies with more than one language current. So it's quite common for people to be very competent in their native language, but quite competent, or, you know, a varying range of competence in the other languages used. So I think one's got to probably envisage a quite varied pattern of how far people would know Hebrew and particularly Greek as well as Aramaic.
Yes, Professor. I have a question on the social standing of John the Evangelist.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to get into the trial of Jesus because he was known to the high priest. In fact, he was even able to get Peter in there, too. Does that necessarily mean that he was a higher social standing, say, maybe his family?
Yes, there is a problem there in the fact that it isn't entirely clear whether that disciple is the beloved disciple. You know, the beloved disciple is usually called the disciple Jesus loved. And at that point, it just says another disciple, I think. And I tend to think probably that is the beloved disciple, but not everyone agrees. But I do agree with you. If that disciple is the beloved disciple, then I think being in some kind of social relationship, it's a very vague term, but being in some kind of social relationship with the high priest would imply, yes, that he belongs to the upper echelons of Jerusalem society. So I entirely agree with you, except there is a sort of somewhat doubtful question of whether that is the beloved disciple. I think probably yes.